Okay, so good morning. We're going to get started. And as usual, get your coffee, rugelach, and all the good stuff. We have a lot to do today, and it's the last one of this series. So, you know, I can never say in my head, okay, so next, I can push something off to next week. There's no more next, well, there will be a next week, God willing, but we will not be here together next week. So we'll finish just in time for Chanukah. Last week we dealt with the principles of conversion, just all the classical halachic sources, and summarized what is required, preferable, unnecessary, and so on. And one important principle that's going to keep on coming back is Rambam's responsum, where he made a particular ruling against the theoretical law, where you had that case of the Jewish man having an affair with his Christian maid. So it's a bad situation from a halachic point of view, meaning it's not good, and they plan on being together. So Rambam said, granting that they plan on being together and there's no way to separate them, so what's the lesser of the two evils? Letting them stay together is intolerable. Do we say she's not allowed to convert and therefore they will continue to live in sin? Or do we say, convert her even though this is less than ideal, because then at least they can get married and everything will be good going forward. So Rambam ruled, we'll convert her. Even though this is a less than ideal situation, she wasn't motivated because of her Jewish idealism. She was motivated because she was attached to this man.
What happened to Keturah?
And of course, good morning, welcome back.
Keturah.
So that decision weighs heavily on modern discussions of the subject. So we move into the 19th century and the whole world is turned upside down, Jewishly. Where instead of the old traditional communal model, the world is in flux. Many Jews are beginning to assimilate. There's the creation of the Reform movement. And for the first time, intermarriage becomes a much bigger threat than it had been. In the olden days, it was very unlikely. You had these rare cases of affairs with the maid, but you didn't have regular dating in coffee houses or in clubs or in college campuses or in fraternities or whatever it is, or just the workplace. It was very unlikely for Jews and non-Jews to marry, because as much as we didn't want to intermarry and they didn't want to marry us. So actually there was deterrent in all directions, which helped from an intermarriage point of view. Now with a freer society, as Jews are emancipated, or at least they thought they were, and were treated for the most part as equal citizens, although not as equal as they sort of had aspired to, as we've discussed, fact is, intermarriage became a much more real issue. And for the first time in the 19th century, you see a proliferation of classical questions that nowadays are old hat. But in the 19th century, they became real ones. One, if you already have an intermarriage, Jewish man, non-Jewish woman, so their child is not Jewish. Let's say it's a boy. And let's say the family wants to have a Brit Milah. Can you perform a Brit Milah? The kid's not Jewish, but can you perform a Brit Milah? So you could argue, why not, right? So some said, yeah, why not? And plus, that way, if one day the child wants to convert, they have one very important step along the way as a baby, rather than having to figure this out for himself as an adult, and then to have circumcision. So some ruled, yeah, absolutely, circumcise. Others said, no, we cannot allow a circumcision, because then the boy will grow up thinking that he is Jewish. And he's not. And not only is he not Jewish, but the likelihood of him growing up to be observant, religiously observant, is tiny, because he's growing up in an intermarried home. So for the first time, rabbis had to have very serious discussions about this very basic question. And the other one is, of course, let's say a couple comes to you and an interdating couple wants to get married. So we all know that ideal motivation is non-Jews come to convert because they want to accept Judaism. Well, now we all know it's for the sake of marriage, which the Talmud says the conversion counts, but it's not ideal and we shouldn't necessarily accept them. Big fights broke out among rabbis, just in principle. What's the right thing to do here? With some rabbis saying, don't touch it. And some rabbis saying, we have an obligation to help, because if we don't help, they're going to get civilly married. They have options now. They didn't have options in 1431. They were the Jewish community ran their own ship. So in the olden days, if they said, sorry, you can't get married, there weren't any other good options. Now you can get civilly married, or you can go to a Reform rabbi. And if the Orthodox Beit Din won't convert you, the Reform Beit Din might convert you, and that's not a conversion in halacha. So for the first time, we had different variables that were in play that simply never existed before, and rabbis had to discuss how to make that happen. So a certain... Right. That's not half Jewish, that's not Jewish. Right?
Yeah.
The law of return, yes. Yes.
In order to, that's a really strong statement.
Right, because the secular state of Israel isn't following halachic protocols, and I understand that. In other words, they're talking about a Jewish nationhood. So from that point of view, if the father is Jewish, then they're still of Jewish stock as much as if the mother is Jewish, right? Even though, according to halacha, there's a big difference between the two of them. So the law of return doesn't follow halacha. Same as law of return, except all converts to Judaism. They don't care what movement you're from, how halachic it was, whose standards you followed. If you come in with a...
Huh? The German didn't follow halacha.
But I think that the law of return, to some degree, mimics the Germans. Love deal. Whoever the Nazis would have killed is somebody that Israel would accept as a citizen. I think that they actually did make some kind of correlation between the two of them. So German rabbis in particular in the 19th century began to argue these cases very strenuously, and there were good principles for both sides. And it mattered, part of the discussion was, what's better for the Jews? Those who opposed these conversions and those who opposed circumcising the baby boy from a Jewish father, not Jewish mother, they said it's better for the Jews to say no. Why? Because this couple will be in limbo, but other Jewish men and women who are dating non-Jews will realize, oh no, we'll never be accepted. So we want to deter future intermarriages. We want to deter this type of process. Another rabbi said, I can't worry about the big, I have to worry about this couple that's in front of me, and I have to worry about this baby. This couple, if we don't do anything about it, will be intermarried. That's terrible, right? If we don't take care of this baby boy whose father is Jewish and they want to give a brit milah, this child is of Jewish stock. It goes back to Avi's point. Even if the child is not halachically Jewish, the term that was used was Zera Yisrael, seed of Israel. This person's of Jewish stock. We, as a rabbinic organization and as a community, we have an obligation to these people. We can't just ignore them or say, oh, fine, go intermarry, but we'll never accept you, because then that couple is in the breach. We're not helping. So this was the fight in terms of, do you focus on the individual in front of you, or do you focus on what's better communal policy to try to minimize this problem? Just to give a nod to what Elisa asked about last time, I'll mention it. The Syrian community in 1935 came up with an all-out ban on all conversion as a means of deterrent. This wasn't a halachic policy, it was a rabbinic decision. They thought that was better for the community to not allow conversion at all. So that way, people wouldn't even dream of dating somebody non-Jewish if they wish to remain within the community, because there won't be conversion at the end of the rainbow. So that was so these are all strategies of what's best for the Jews. What I try to do in the shiurim is keep out all the ugliness of politics, which are unfortunately really there, and certain people, besides the really sick folk who are in the rabbinic establishment, even just rabbis who use this as a platform for power, or giving prospective converts runarounds, or all the other terrible things and horror stories that you will read about very regularly in Angel for Shabbat and other venues, because unfortunately it is a real problem. I'm not talking about that ugly stuff. That's horrible. That's just pure sinful behavior. There's nothing good about that. I'm interested in the principled discussion between rabbis of good conscience who have different points of view of how to interpret the halakha to apply to today. I'm interested in the battle of principle today, and anything that's ugly is ugly and horrible, and it makes me very sick that rabbis use their positions for all kinds of abuses of prospective converts and even people who have converted, and they start challenging the validity of the conversion. Those are true sinful, that's just true sinful behavior. That's not today's topic. Today's topic is there's validity to a restrictive position, and there's validity to a more inclusive position. And I'm interested in how these things played out. One great rabbi in Germany in the 19th century, his name was Raphael.
Yeah, the Syrians, still a lot of the Syrians don't marry a convert.
Okay? I mentioned that. That's a social policy.
But still now.
I'm aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even marry a non-Syrian.
Right. So, well, that's a different issue. But no, what Raphael is saying is absolutely correct. Rav David Zvi Hoffmann in the 19th century in Germany, he realized that the world is just different. He said, now we have such a thing as civil marriage. We have non-Orthodox rabbis who are perfectly fine performing what they call conversions and performing what they call marriages, even though neither one of them follow halakha at all, and therefore they're not recognized in Jewish law. But it's a reality. Meaning if a couple comes to an Orthodox Beit Din and says, we want to convert, or the non-Jewish one wants to convert, if the Orthodox Beit Din says no, they'll just go to a Reform rabbi. Or they'll just get married civilly and they'll be fully, you know, they'll be intermarried in every sense. They won't even care. So Rav Hoffman said, we have to take that seriously. We live in a different world. And therefore, he invoked the principle of the lesser of the two evils. Everybody knows the ideal conversion is full commitment to Judaism, full acceptance of beliefs, observances, being part of the observant community. And it's also ideal if there's no intermarriage, right? But given that these are the realities, he said, we have a responsibility to prevent every single intermarriage that we can. And we also have a responsibility to offspring who have Jewish DNA, even if they're not halakhically Jewish. He said, that's our obligation. And we have to do everything possible to let them in because it is the lesser of the two evils. But he insisted that anybody, the non-Jewish spouse in the equation, has to accept, to keep, verbally accept Shabbat, Kashrut, and the laws of family purity. Otherwise for him, it was simply not a conversion either. That was his standard. He said, we need to teach them the laws of Shabbat, teach them Kashrut, teach them family purity laws. They need to accept to keep them. And if they do, we are, even if they weren't nobly motivated. His argument was, they are nobly motivated. How do I know? Because they chose to come to an Orthodox rabbi. They didn't have to. We live in an age where nobody needs to come to an Orthodox rabbi. So if they do, that shows commitment. And he argued the same for circumcising the baby boy. He said, if the Jewish father wants to circumcise his son, that's sincere because he didn't have to. So it depends how you define sincerity here, and it makes a very, very, very big difference. Yeah. It depends how you define commitment. That's exactly what the debate is. What type of commitment is required? Is it some general sense of, I accept Judaism? Or is it, no, I need to know 100% of it, which nobody does, and to agree to consider all of it. So Rav Hoffman said that halakha doesn't require full knowledge of the subject. You're not allowed to reject. A convert is not allowed to reject laws. If he says, look, I think Judaism is this minus Shabbat, that's not Judaism. But if I say, I accept to be a Jew, I accept to live a Jewish life, that's a sincere conversion for some. This battle raged into the 20th century. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, one of the great decisors of the Ashkenazic world and of the world in general, argued very strenuously that if a convert doesn't accept to keep all of the mitzvot, it's simply not a conversion at all. And he obviously carried a great deal of weight. He said, a convert must accept 100%. That's what acceptance means. And opposing him was Rav Ben Sion Uziel, who we've already talked about. His point of view is that the halakha never required that. Halakha doesn't even require a verbal acceptance to keep the mitzvot at all. Halakha demands that we teach them some of the mitzvot. We talked about all this last week and saw the sources. Some of the mitzvot, basic Jewish beliefs, tell them that to be Jewish is serious business, and then if they nod their head and mean it, and the rabbi feels that they're sincere, that's good enough. And then he invoked Rav Hoffman's principle that we have an obligation to every single couple to prevent intermarriage. And he said, actually, here's the protocol. Let's say a non-Jew and a Jew come to the Orthodox rabbi. To him, that already means that they mean business, because they didn't have to come to an Orthodox rabbi at all. They could get married civilly. The first thing the Orthodox rabbi should do is try to break up the couple. Try to persuade them not to get married at all. You guys don't really love each other. You're a Jewish man, you're better off marrying a Jewish woman, non-Jewish woman, you're better. He said that's the first thing a Beit Din has to do. If it is clear to the Beit Din that they're planning on staying together no matter what, now it's our obligation to perform a conversion. And he says the mere fact that the non-Jewish person has come to an Orthodox rabbi, that's enough. That shows that they're sincere enough, and you let them in. And then you perform the wedding if need be. Very often that might happen even on the same day. And he invoked Rambam's principle. He said it's the lesser of the two evils. Just like Rambam ruled that the Jewish man could marry the maid, can do the conversion, do the marriage. It's not an ideal world situation. But Rav Uziel's point is, guess what, folks? We don't live in an ideal world. So we have an obligation to every single intermarrying couple to try to stop it. And we have an obligation to every child who's born from an intermarriage. We have a responsibility. And by the way, let's say the mother is Jewish and the father is not Jewish, and they have a baby. So what's the baby?
Jewish.
Baby's Jewish. Rav Uziel says we still have an obligation to convert the father if the father comes. Why? Because the child should grow up in a Jewish home. even though the child is Jewish already. But it doesn't matter. The child shouldn't have to grow up in an intermarried home. So if the couple comes to the rabbi afterwards and says, look, the man wants to convert, that's it. Go for it. It's your obligation to stop the intermarriage. It's your obligation to give this child a full Jewish home. It's a whole different perspective on what one should do. So his point of view was, yes, the world is less than ideal and this protocol is less than ideal, but given that the world is very, very, very far cry from ideal, this is the best communal policy. You should know that besides my father, who wrote on Rav Uziel from, it was his first tradition article, and he's written a book on him since, I was at an Orthodox Forum conference a few years ago where Rabbi Benny Lau in Israel presented on Rabbi Uziel. I was so happy that somebody else presented on Rabbi Uziel, so I raised my hand. It's the only time I ever participated at a forum. I congratulated him for quoting Rav Uziel. I said he really needs to be more on the map. But I said, until the rabbinic establishments in America, Israel, everywhere else take this position seriously, then it just becomes an academic paper. And what we need to do is, will the rabbinic courts entertain this as a real possibility? If they say that's very nice that he said that, but we simply ignore him, well then it's very nice that he thinks that, but it doesn't become a position that is used. So that's the big debate that's still going on today. For the most part, most rabbinic establishments in Israel, America, and most Batei Din have drafted the principle that a convert must accept to keep all of the mitzvot. And that has resulted in very lengthy process of learning. Right? In other words, if you have to actually commit to keep all the mitzvot, well, first you need to know what they are. That takes a lot of time, right? So that's where the establishment has tilted. And then a second problem comes up, because the establishment, for the most part, is saying that anybody who converts with a Beit Din that doesn't follow that position, it's not a conversion. That's actually the worst of the two problems. They're both problems. But by saying that others who follow Rabbi Uziel, who follow Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman and others, who said we have a responsibility to stop intermarriage, by delegitimizing those conversions or delegitimizing those Batei Din, that actually creates a system where most people who are in intermarriage situations will remain intermarried because no Orthodox Beit Din will touch it. I remember when I was a rabbinical student, so my teacher was teaching this position, the teacher who taught the laws of conversion was teaching. He said, unless you're willing to wager $100,000, which for a rabbi is a lot of money, unless you're willing to wager $100,000 that the prospective convert will keep 100% of Jewish law, if you're not willing to bet that, then don't do the conversion. So up goes my hand. I say, look, I'm never going to wager $100,000 on anything. But what you're telling all of us rabbinical students, is we never can perform conversions. Because none of us will bet $100,000 on that. It doesn't matter how sincere we think that person is. It's too iffy. And that means that every single time we have an intermarriage situation in front of us, or an adoption, by the way, where both parents are Jewish, if you're not convinced that the parents are going to raise the kid 100% observant, that they're saying you can't perform the conversion on the kid. They have adopted a child, which is an incredibly brave, heroic, and amazing act of the parents, right? And now you're telling them, sorry, your kid can't be Jewish unless you promise that they will keep 100% of the law. So what you're saying is, in even these cases, you're telling all of us we never can do the conversion. We're going to have to tell them, go to the Reform rabbi. We're not going to have to say those words, but that's what we're, as a matter of policy, saying. I protested vigorously because I'm my father's son. I couldn't help it. You know, I was younger then, but it didn't matter. I felt that the whole concept of how we were being taught was false to communal.
He's smarter than his father.
I don't understand the process. They come to you as a rabbi.
Right.
Do you then take this to a Beit Din, or do you?
Well, the good old days versus the now, right? In other words. In the good old days, I mean, I got to perform several conversions, and it was an unbelievable privilege. Even better than that, by the way, you know what was really awesome for me? Back when Rabbi Josh Lookstein worked for his father at KJ, this goes back several years, so Rabbi Lookstein could not work with Josh on a Beit Din, because you can't have just like I couldn't work with my father. Relatives can't sit on a Beit Din together. So Rabbi Lookstein often invited me, which was great, because I got to see a master at work, and Rabbi Lookstein is fabulous. And you know, he would get into his swimming trunks when it was a baby and go into the mikvah, hold the baby, dunk the baby. He did it all himself. He made it each one so special, so meaningful, so dignified. You know, Rabbi Lookstein has a certain flair about him. And it was really great as a young rabbi seeing a master at work. It was a privilege to be part of that. The new system, I mean, I'm not a rabbi. I have smicha. I didn't stop being Rabbi Angel, but I'm not a practicing rabbi right now, so I haven't been involved in conversion at all in the last couple of years. But toward the end of that, when the Rabbinical Council of America decided to adopt the Israeli chief rabbinate plan of the Israeli chief rabbinate will accept conversions only that go through the Rabbinical Council of America system. So I would meet with prospective converts and say, I would do exactly what Halakha asked me to do. Tell them, you know, you're going to face a ton of anti-Semitism. Are you sure you know what you're getting into? There will be a course of study, all of these, and you have to get involved in the community, all these things. And then I say, okay, now here come the politics. I can perform the conversion and you will be halachically Jewish. But it might be in your political best interest to go through the Rabbinical Council of America system. In other words, I would recommend them when the time comes. So that way, the Israeli chief rabbinate will accept it. And I said, it's ugly and it frustrates me to have to say this, but it might be prudent, especially if it's a young woman who's converting into a marriage that affects their children also. So I just said, it's in your best interest to do this. And by the way, at least with the current Beit Din system, I found that it took longer. But I didn't have too much trouble. And once I felt confident and spoke to the head of the Beit Din, it worked out okay. It was once, at least with the current Beit Din system. The predecessor was required several complaints from me because I came to bat for my people. I wasn't going to allow somebody who went through the process, was sincere, ready to convert, and then suddenly there was a runaround. I said, no way. But I had to intervene to make those things stop. So there are glitches in that system, to put it mildly. So just to summarize the major debate on the table, by the way, well, first let's summarize the debate, then we'll mention one hero out in Israel who's fighting the good fight and doing a fabulous job, and I hope he eventually prevails. The predominant view in the Orthodox rabbinate today, which has great opinions on its side, is that a convert must accept 100% of all observance, which means that they have to know a ton, and then to commit, which obviously significantly restricts the number of people who ever will convert, right? And that's the predominant position. There are rabbis who disagree with that position, I'm glad that there are, and who follow other great rabbis such as Rabbi Hoffman or Rabbi Uziel, who is actually far more inclusive, who say we have an obligation to stop as much intermarriage as we can, and we have an obligation to help every child of Jewish stock as we can. And okay, the world is imperfect, but we must accept minimal standards to allow as many of these people in as possible. And so I'm hoping that the Rabbi Uziel side will get a lot more PR. One person who's making a very good fight for it is Rabbi Chaim Amzalem in Israel. He's doing a wondrous job, and he's an exceptionally learned man who's publishing volumes and volumes of responses saying that the Rabbi Uziel position essentially is what so many great rabbis have felt and argued over the years. Here's a whole book. Dear all you rabbis who work in Batei Din, read this book. And you realize that we have a lot more latitude than what you're insisting on, and we need to use that. The most easy example is you have a woman who's 37 years old, right? She wants to have children. She wants to get married. If you start giving her a five-year process and then a runaround, this is a disaster, right? It's just an absolute disaster. But it's not just for women who want to have a child or children with their spouse. It's really for everybody, and it certainly affects parents of adoption very greatly. So we're very pro the Rabbi Uziel position. What I'm more pro about is to make sure that Batei Din understand that there are other positions within halakha, and they should at least accept those rabbis' conversions who follow other halakhic positions. That's what I think is more important.
So how do you define the motivation for the stringency? I mean, I know we all have our own opinions as to why this might be going on, and the ugliness certainly can go on and on.
Right.
But what would you say, in the purest of form, is the motivation for the stringency?
The restrictive position is, I think I admire the restrictive position. I don't think it's the only way to go, and it certainly doesn't match the classical sources, but the restrictive position would say, we who are born Jewish are obligated to the Torah. Some of us do more, some of us do less, but it's all because our mom was Jewish. If you're converting to Judaism, you need to accept Judaism, right? And by the way, everybody agrees that that sentence is true. The question is, what's the minimum requirement of what it means to accept Judaism? So the restrictive position says you need to accept it all, right? The more inclusive position says as long as you understand some vague sense of what Judaism is going to require, you understand that you need to be part of an Orthodox community, that you're going to educate your children Jewishly, right? There's a lot more latitude in that sentence. Rabbi Amzalem said with regard to Israel, and we're getting over to Israel right now, that basically somebody is going to commit to keep what's called a traditional lifestyle. They're keeping the holidays, they're going to synagogue, they're having a Friday night dinner and lighting candles. Even if they're not doing 100%, that's enough to convert them. In other words, it's not ideal. Nobody thinks that that's ideal. But the point is, when you have hundreds of thousands of people who are halakhically not Jewish, who are fighting for the Jewish state, who are living in Israel and casting their fate with the Jewish people, we need to convert all of them, because otherwise there's going to be a lot of intermarriage. In other words, that's what's better for the Jews. Whereas the restrictive position, going back to Elisa's question, is saying we have to look at case by case, every single individual, are they accepting 100%? If they're not, I'm sorry that we have social problems, but we can't do anything. Right? So that's the principled part of the discussion.
I have a question of what people born Jewish perceive their Judaism to be. A couple years ago, there was an article that came out, a friend of mine actually wrote it, about social orthodoxy, which created like a whole group to do. But a lot of what he said may be very accurate because of sort of people who feel committed to Judaism and traditionally through their families were Orthodox, but maybe if you sat down and questioned their sort of, you know, understanding of Judaism, they don't appear at all Orthodox.
Correct.
Like lots of people like that.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
and so I think it's very hard to sort of, you can live a Jewish lifestyle and pick and choose. It's very, and everybody picks and chooses.
Right.
So I think it's become a very.
The Jewish world is a very complicated landscape in the modern era, again, because everybody has freedom to choose what he and she wants to do. We all have that choice. But when it comes to conversion, the debate is over when you're letting somebody in the door, what is the responsibility of the rabbinate? So one position is we need to help break up every intermarriage we can and solve as many intermarriage situations, and we have an obligation to every child with Jewish DNA. That's one position. The other position is we're looking at every single convert candidate and asking, are you going to accept Judaism? We know that not all Jews practice it fully, exactly what Elisa said. Mm-hmm. But you can remain non-Jewish, right? You don't have to convert. If you want to convert, you need to accept it all. That's the fundamental debate. The problem today is that those who take the more restrictive position have for more and more delegitimized the other way. They're saying rabbis who perform conversions with the more inclusive position, those conversions don't count. Or they question the conversions of people who already have converted with Orthodox Beit Din. This is a terrible sin. The problem isn't to disagree with the position. That's fine. There's a real principled debate here of how to apply halakhic sources to modern life, and both sides have merit. But both sides need to understand that the other side is a fair halakhic position. And therefore, conversions that go through either process are fine. They're absolutely halakhically acceptable. And once somebody converts to Judaism, that conversion is irreversible. Nobody can take it away. So converts need to feel once you're in halakhically, you're in forever. It's just like when you're born. You're born forever. You can't be unborn as a result of some rabbi questioning the conversion.
Rabbi, I've heard that once you're Jewish and you're born Jewish, you're Jewish forever.
Mm-hmm.
But those, let's say, convert to Christianity or to Muslim, they're still Jews, right?
They are still, halakhically, they're Jewish. We call them sinners. In other words, they're doing something that is wrong, but they're still Jews. In other words, you can't undo a conversion or undo Jewishness. If somebody's born Jewish, same thing. If they become what's called an apostate, they convert out of Judaism, so they might adopt a whole different religious system. But as far as we view them, we see them as Jews who are sinning, rather than, okay, they stop being Jewish.
Did they try to do something with the philosopher Spinoza?
That was different. They didn't say he wasn't Jewish. They wanted to, well, they did. They excommunicated him. Right? So, right. Hard there too. Of course they do. In other words, our ideal world position is that every single Orthodox rabbi needs to be able to decide his cases, because only he knows. If to have some rabbi from very far away making decisions for all the Jews like a pope, that's the problem. Whereas that's when all of a sudden individual local rabbis who are talking to real people and having to deal with real cases, you don't want somebody who's coming from outside, who doesn't know the people involved at all or their circumstances, and to make sweeping policy decisions. That's what's harmed the rabbinate very greatly, particularly just in the last decade, where the chief rabbinate of Israel decided they have the power to annul or deny any Orthodox conversion. But they bless them, you know, I wish them nothing but good, but that's a terrible decision. Right? It was very harmful for the Jews, not just for the people who have converted and suddenly are worrying about whether they're Jewish or not. It's just bad for the Jews, given our intermarriage rates, given the people who just want to adopt children, forgetting about any serious seeker. I was in Kansas City a week ago as a scholar in residence and just met a Christian couple. Both of them are Christians, very religious Christians. And then at one point they were ill, so they had a chance to read books about the Jewish roots to Christianity, and they fell in love with it as a couple. And they say, we want to convert. So here they are going through this process. It's awesome. I love people like that. Mm-hmm. You know, here they are as a couple making this life-changing decision to go through this process. And they've been studying for years. I mean, it's a whole journey. And here it's not an intermarriage case. It's not an adoption case, which are the far most common situations. And then also another common situation is just father Jewish, mother not Jewish, product of an intermarriage. That's another very common conversion situation. Okay? There are uncommon ones too. So we like Rabbi Amzalem and hope that he does a lot of good with his position of trying to say that, in particular in Israel, but honestly in America too and anywhere else, we have an obligation to have wider openings, because
our institute published two of Rabbi Amzalem's books.
We did. We published it. We helped publish two of his books and have published him in conversations as well. Rabbi Amzalem is really one of the bright stars in Israel fighting the good fight. I just hope that he's able to make practical headway rather than just theoretical.
He's Ashkenazi or Sephardic?
He happens to be Sephardic, but I want Sephardic and Ashkenazic rabbis to be part of this. This isn't a Sephardic Ashkenazic thing. This is a Jewish thing, right? So the biggest, in terms of creating Jewish unity, the thing that would solve the most problems for the Jews, honestly, is given that there are principal debates that are underlying it, forgetting about all the ugliness and power struggles and this and that, but just in terms of the principal debates, the Orthodox rabbinate all just needs to realize that given that there are multiple halachic positions, they all need to be validly accepted by the entire Orthodox rabbinate. Because if it doesn't, that creates very big problems for the converts, for prospective converts, and for really the entire Jewish people.
Is there a strong continuing difference between the chief rabbinate therefore?
I mean, at the moment, the chief rabbinate, it's a good question. I don't know the new chief rabbi's positions on this, but for the most part, they've been working in tandem in terms of becoming ridiculously restrictive and unnecessarily, that's the point, restrictive on an international level. In Israel itself, there's a whole new, rabbis began to realize the state of Israel is different from Chutzlar, different from the diaspora. Because all of a sudden, you have people who are committed to the Jewish people in a whole different way. They're giving their lives in the army. Right? That's pretty big. They're casting their life with the Jewish people. They're doing everything that Jews are doing over there. So when you have hundreds of thousands of them, largely from the former Soviet Union, but not exclusively, who are not halachically Jewish, do the rules of the game change? And in fact, many rabbis say yes. You have to look at Israel as a whole different can of worms. So Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun, by the way, who's famed as a Tanakh scholar, and then we'll get to Rebecca, but he also is a good halachist, he said that what we need to do is actually get all these non-Jews into like a baseball stadium. I guess there would be a soccer stadium, let's be realistic, into some big stadium and have a mass conversion ceremony. Because the court system can't handle 300,000 people one by one. So he says if these people commit to some minimal standard of peoplehood and some minimal standard of observance, just convert them all at once. And what he's trying to do is stress, we have to find solutions. It's not enough to deal one by one anymore. In America, most commonly,
The Russian Jewish people?
Not people who are born Jewish, people from the Russian Jewish community who, let's say, who the father's Jewish and the mother is not Jewish. People who are not halachically Jewish, but they're affiliated genetically with the Jewish people, and now they live in Israel.
But some of them, they actually don't want to be Jewish. They left.
If they don't want to, that's another. Then nobody's going to convert them. Yeah, Rebecca.
No, I was going to say that
some of them want, but others are with crosses and all that.
You know, you're painting a picture of now that we have Israel, everything should be more inclusive because we have these people who indeed are putting their lives on the line. At the same time, the flip side of the coin is that you have a political motive for converting that is especially before the Iron Curtain, fell, that people can only get out by saying, oh yeah, sure, I want to be Jewish, help me convert.
Your point is very well taken.
The second thing is that the genetic link, to me has always kind of that in a weird way because it smacks of this kind of, what's the word that I'm looking for?
The
kind of essentialism, but also something even more.
It need not be essentialism. The fact of the matter is that Jewishness has a genetic component, right? In other words, we do, if
yes and no, because there are so many, and we've talked about how, like, sometimes the most stringent or Hasidic sects are, like, these pale Polish-looking people who don't appear to have come
from sure.
Stock of
right.
the Middle East. So.
No, your point is, both points are very well taken, so let's do one at a time. In terms of the motive for coming to Israel, on some level you're right. Rabbi Herzog, actually the first the Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel at the founding of the state, ruled that if non-Jews come from lands that are safe, in other words, if they're not fleeing for their lives coming to Israel, then that already is a sign of commitment if they want to convert. He said if they're fleeing for their lives, then that doesn't show any sincerity at all. That's in the case of people who are fleeing. But now that they're, and that position is very well taken, in other words, if they're trying to make aliyah to get a better lifestyle, then the state of Israel or the rabbinate in Israel might want to be more restrictive. Yeah. This was a huge swath of them. Sure. But now that these people live in Israel, let's say that, and not all of them want to convert, but the ones who actually do want to enter the Jewish fold, at this point, they don't have to anymore. They're there. They live in Israel. They're citizens. They're fighting in the army. They have jobs. So the position of Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, Yigal Ariel, and others, just in the spirit of Rabbi Uziel, is, okay, and Rabbi Amzalem also, given that they're here now, what do we do? If we just leave things alone, there's 300,000 of them, they're still marrying, everybody's still marrying everybody. So you just end up with intermarriage within Israel, and lots of it. So it's still part of the lesser of the two evils. But your point is still very well taken in terms of people who are clearly just fleeing lands and using Israel or using the law of return and using conversion to get the law of return. Then there's much more reason to be restrictive, by the way, unless you just want to help them as a humanitarian thing. But don't get the rabbis involved. The state of Israel could just let in immigrants, not via the law of return.
Mm-hmm. Until I became an Israeli citizen and lived in Israel, and I suddenly realized that by having this low bar, you know, you're allowing all these people with very tenuous connection to the people of Israel to kind of jump to the front of the line, where all these Arabs are kind of, you know, living, many of them are living like in the 19th century with their donkeys and so forth and kind of struggling. And to me, it just felt like, you know, definitely I support, you know, the right of the people of Israel to live in the land, but I kind of questioned whether I felt so good about having somebody do some quick, you know, things and kind of jump into this place that...
All fair. I mean, that's raising a whole different can of worms, and an important can of worms in terms of how we, you know, just... That opens up a lot of different questions, which are good, but it takes me far away from where I need to be. But your points are all very well taken. That all being said, by the way, Rabbi Chaim David Alevi, who was the chief disciple of, you know, was the main student of Rabbi Uziel, he argued, he didn't accept Rabbi Uziel's position fully. He didn't reject it. He wanted a higher bar. He was tormented because he understood that both positions have a lot of merit. So he argued, Ein la dayan ela mashe enav ra'ot. The real principle in halakha is that each rabbi needs to use his own two eyes. And that's, in other words, but that should be left to each rabbi to use his own two eyes. Now, his point was, there's no one right judgment that's right for all Jews of all times. Different, and today, people are debating, and I think legitimately, forgetting about the ugliness, there are legitimate debates over where that bar should be, for all sorts of reasons, and what's best for the Jews. What should be motivating the debates, though, is what is best for the Jews, right? As opposed to power politics and all the ugliness that we see. If that's the debate, then what is best for the Jews, regardless of what any individual halachic position is just being able for rabbis to be able to understand there are other halachic positions and to accept converts from all of those batei din. Once somebody converted through an Orthodox Beit Din, even if another Beit Din would never have touched the case, they should realize, okay, now the person is converted. That would create a lot more Jewish unity. It would not solve all of our problems. None of these shiurim are going to solve all of our problems, but I'm hoping that these positions, the more we promote them, more people will realize that's what the Jewish people need. That these positions are very, very important for Israel, they're important for the diaspora, and it's important for the rabbinate to be thinking about what really is best for the Jews. And this brings us to one last point, the Sephardic communal model. We have to wrap up with this. So I'll talk about Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's not Sephardic, but he is really one of the great exponents of what's good for the Jews. I really think he's an excellent spokesperson for the Jewish people. And he actually understood the Sephardic position from within Ashkenazic England. So he starts off by talking about Ra-Ra Sisbumba. He doesn't call it the Sephardic communal model. He calls it the inclusive Orthodox model, which is the idea that Orthodox, in an ideal world, all synagogues would be what today is called Orthodox. They would be faithful to tradition. All schools would be faithful to tradition. And the people, given that not everybody is observant 100%, and Elisa raised even within the people who affiliate with the Orthodox community, there's quite a variety of people, belief, observance, picking, choosing, not sureness, all of that stuff. But the institutions would all be run according to halacha. Okay? And everybody would be welcomed. In other words, all Jews would be welcomed as, hey, you're part of the family. That's the ideal. And the entire Sephardic world, one of its great brilliance during the 19th century is that it didn't fragment into movements like the Ashkenazic world, particularly Germany. And then America, and now lots of the world, is tormented because of this fragmentation, which is terrible. I remember when I used to give tours to Reform and Conservative confirmation classes, I always made a point of getting away from history and just focusing on how in the Sephardic world there is no such thing as Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. We're all Jews. And all of a sudden you would just watch that barrier melt, because here they are talking to an Orthodox rabbi. They didn't know what to think of me. And they're all of a sudden hearing, it's like, wait a minute, you just look at us as Jews? I'm like, yeah, I don't believe in adjectives. And they loved that. And their rabbis loved that too, by the way. They loved the fact that we could just all sit together in the room and talk together as fellow Jews, discussing Judaism and Jewish history and all the different things that we have to do.
Do you think it still applies, though? I mean, we brought up the Syrian community. I see huge fragmentation in that community. Maybe they haven't addressed it, but they're experiencing it.
There's a lot of fragmentation. But movements are a different kind of fragmentation, because all of a sudden, there's fragmentation within the Orthodox community also, some of which is just painfully unnecessary, and yeah, that bothers me too, and I think the movement model is simply consuming much of the world. So
just
that,
a westernization.
Yeah, everybody can make a movement. You're absolutely right.
And the reaction, liberalism. Yeah. All the inclusion. Now you have that shift to the right. You see
that
as well.
Not just Jewish. I think that many religious communities realize that the Western civilization is so morally bankrupt in so many ways that there's like a counterculture. So Christian fundamentalism also is vastly on the rise, exactly as a counterculture to the libertarianism of much of Western culture. So the starting point is that Ra-Ra Sisbumba, the idea that we can all see ourselves as Jews and be one united community and have synagogues and schools where everybody is welcome, it sounds wonderful. So then Rabbi Sacks asked the hard question. So why did everybody else not see that as obvious? In other words, so many intelligent people didn't do that. So no, it's not all politics. There's some principle too. There's always politics, but there's principle also. I'm interested in principle. I don't care about politics. I know it's there, but that's not what I talk about. That's not even how I think about the world. I'm interested in what are the battles of principle. Yeah.
Maybe easy come, easy go. That's what motivated.
Yeah. Some of it, what Rabbi Sacks said it very well. It's in the spirit of what Rebecca is saying. But he said it has to do with consistency. The Sephardic communal model is the least consistent model. Because the people on the left were saying, why in the world should we go to synagogues that are saying we should keep Shabbat and keep Kashrut and we believe that God revealed the Torah when we don't think those things and we don't do those things? Let's form synagogues and movements that are consistent with our lifestyles. And then on the right, they were saying, why should we welcome Jews that don't keep what we do, what we believe in? We want to start synagogues and schools that are 100% like us.
That's right, community-based.
Right. Yes. So these were, and that's why there's so much fragmentation. Fragmentation occurred because people want consistency. They want their schools and synagogues and religious groups, and now it's easier with like the internet. You could just form your own community worldwide with like-minded people and who think exactly like you do. You can watch your news station that follows your politics. Everything is so fragmented, and you simply bond with the people who are just like you. And you don't have to care about anybody else. It's actually far more consistent, the fragmentation into movements and other fragmentations and all the divisions, that's actually very consistent. Because people have to find that little narrow box where they feel like they can fit and belong and associate with other people who all think and feel more or less the same way. So that tradition has debates, but there's a very big difference between debates and fragmentation. So again, there are always debates. I'm glad that we disagree, and we're always going to disagree, and we should disagree. But there's a disagreeing community where everybody realizes we're one family and we can all get along and eat at each other's homes and accept each other's converts and teach Torah together. And one which is fragmented, where we can't marry each other, we can't eat in each other's homes. That's a different kind. We can't pray in each other's synagogues. Yeah, Rebecca? Correct. Very, very well put. Yeah.
You know, game room.
Yes, everybody gets a game room. And that's exactly right. The reason, so Rabbi Sacks argues that, and it's very important to understand that that's where fragmentation comes from. It comes from people wanting consistency. Why should I have to be in a room with people who are so different and who are so different in observance and belief? And why should the synagogue be so different from me? I'd rather go to a synagogue that's like me and where everybody in the room is like me. That feels like community. Why do I want to, on a religious level, that makes a lot of sense actually. So Rabbi Sacks says, what's the response of an inclusive model? Exactly what Rebecca just said. The Sephardic community model, how'd they hold everybody together? They said, this is what Judaism is, this is what it always has been, and we're not going to change Judaism. We can't do that. We should have an inclusive interpretation of Judaism, that's for sure, but we're keeping it as Judaism. And we want everybody to respect that, and everybody did. Everybody said, we want the synagogue to reflect Judaism. We want our schools to reflect Judaism, even if we don't live a life fully consistent with that. So congregants had a huge respect for the institutions, for the rabbis, for the schools, and understood that they were part of a community that believed in what Jews have always believed. And they were part of a community that observed what Jews have always observed, even if they don't personally observe it or believe it. But they want to be part of that, and they want to raise their children in that atmosphere. That's how the Sephardic model is so valuable. When I was in Kansas City, I gave a sermon about the Sephardic model. It's not a Sephardic synagogue. And people were flooding over there saying, absolutely. It really struck a chord. And I've spoken about it in numerous communities by now. And people are shocked to hear, oh, there's an alternative to this foolishness that we've done. You know, why can't we, even if we fundamentally disagree and we fundamentally have difference in observance, and there are big differences. Religion does divide us, even though it's meant to unite us. It does divide us in observance. I mean, one of the great lines, once a secular Israeli general was talking about Pesach in Israel, and he got up there and he said, you know, even though we Jews, some of us are very observant, some don't observe anything, Pesach unites us all. We have the same story, the same foundation, we can all come together and we can all have a Seder. That's what unites us. And then Professor Yeshaya Leibowitz gets up and he says, actually, Pesach is when we're most divided. I can't even go to your house and drink a cup of water on Pesach because you don't observe anything. Right? Pesach shows our division more than Tuesdays do. Right? Yes, we have the same story, but in the meantime, halakha is so important to an observant Jew. It's like, I can't even eat in your home. I can't even have your water because I don't trust your dishes. I don't trust that you cleaned your house for Pesach sufficiently. So
you cannot wear your matzah.
And of course, both of these points of view are true. And Yeshaya Leibowitz was always looking for that good, stark formulation. But going back to Rabbi Sacks and what we're driving at, which is a Sephardic communal model, which I think is just a better way to hold the Jewish people together, the whole point is that the institutions must be fully faithful to tradition. And at the same time, as inclusive as possible, as welcoming as possible to all Jews, realizing we have a responsibility to everybody. We're not just welcoming people who are like us. We have to welcome people who are not like us. And in fact, we want everybody to be part of that community, unless they're really like criminals, but yeah.
Isn't that the model of the Chabad too?
Differently, they welcome everybody through the door, that's for sure. And everybody talks about
it. People arriving in the suburban communities.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In many ways they emulate that. In many ways they have other issues. And that's a whole different can of worms, which I don't want to go to today. But in terms of their welcomingness, yes, that welcomingness is something that I think is of extreme importance and that the entire Jewish community should emulate.
So funny.
With Simon has a question.
Sorry, yeah, Simon?
Not that I disagree with what you're saying, but it does require everyone to at least accept the Sephardic model in the sense of when you come to the synagogue, the Orthodox synagogue, that, you know, the kashrut is observed, et cetera, et cetera. So it still requires an acceptance.
Yes. In other words, that's exactly what needs to happen. That's the second half of my sentence. Not only do I agree with you, but I was about to say that point. Meaning the institutions need to be welcoming, and the people who come need to be absolutely respectful of the institutions and their values. They need to realize, regardless of where I'm at on my journey, I respect the fact that the institution represents Judaism. That cannot change. And I want to be part of it. And maybe I'll change, maybe my children will get more committed, whatever it's going to be. If they don't, if there's disrespect to the institution, or to the school, or to the fundamental values that make Judaism Judaism, then we haven't achieved anything. That's not an ideal community at all.
Why would it not be better if one were marketing such a description to call it traditional?
That's actually what it is. This is Jewish tradition.
Exactly.
Right.
That is what it is.
Today,
if it calls it tradition, then the other people cannot usurp it and say, no, the
right.
tradition has done such a way.
Fundamentally, you're absolutely right, and I can't stand these labels. I like the word traditional. The problem is that even traditional now comes with a capital T. In other words, there are synagogues that are Orthodox, and there are synagogues that are traditional. Right? In other words, that actually has meaning, as opposed to, I agree with you, the historical sense of Orthodoxy is the heir to Jewish tradition. So basically, if we just didn't have these adjectives and just said, okay, the rabbinate has to follow tradition, then yeah, it should be traditional in that way. Yeah.
I mean, I think the Sephardic model only worked when it was in Sephardic lands. My husband is Sephardic, as you know. And,
yes.
I think that just like all the other factions of Judaism, they blame the Ashkenazim, which I don't appreciate, but I think it's just Western society. They're the least inclusive people I've ever encountered, and that is even to similarly observant levels of Jews.
Because
I'm Syrian.
So that's why.
My mother-in-law was half Ashkenaz also, but I'm just saying that I've heard many proud Sephardic rabbis talk about the Sephardic model, and I completely get it. When you live in the same community for thousands of years in Syria, or even when you were thrown out of Spain and came for hundreds of years, you know, to other countries, you kept tight in that community. But once you were dispersed into the world, like the Ashkenazim unfortunately were, you suffer from the same ills. You don't have names for it, but I see huge dichotomies in the Sephardic community. Either you've completely become off the reservation, or you're also trending to the right. And you don't like anybody except your relatives.
Can I fully disagree with, what's your name?
Alisa.
But I fully disagree because I actually see the opposite. I think that, I mean, in both in America and in Israel, there's something about people who are of Sephardic descent that I think the word that that Rabbi Chaim used, which is respect, there's an element of respect that is somehow, you know, it's still there regardless of what the person's doing. And when they come into a synagogue, there's just something that's different. And I think that the Ashkenazic model has always fostered so much dissent. And that's not to say there's not dissent in the Sephardic world, but it's in a different vein. And I think in Israel, I remember, you know, the first times I went to Israel being shocked that on Yom Kippur, you have these people flood into the synagogue who did nothing during the year, who were eating whatever and not keeping Shabbat, but yet they came in and had like a certain reverence for this model.
And a reverence.
And even in Sephardic synagogues, when you see people coming in who clearly, you know, have no connection to the actual observance, I mean, you know, you see them hiding their phones on Shabbat and so forth, but there's a certain way of relating to the synagogue that I think is just different.
But that's two different things.
Right. I think I have to be a good rabbi, even though I'm not a rabbi anymore. You're both right.
You were a rabbi.
Right. No, the reality is that there's truth on both ends in terms of the reverence and in terms of the fragmentation. And I think Elisa's right in the sense that Western culture has kind of fostered this sense of fragmentation. In other words, everybody should just be with people who are just like them. Why do we need to bother with? So I'm arguing that we need to bother. As a Jewish community, we need to care about that. Even though I am aware of the fact that so many people fragment, put themselves into little boxes. When I was in Hillcrest a few weeks ago as a scholar in residence, I was giving a talk on something completely different. But one woman in the back was agitated. She said, you know, there's so many brands of Orthodoxy. How do I know which one to do? And so I told her, I said, look, it's your choice. I can't tell you which one to pick. But I said, it's sad that, and it's not about her. It's about how so many people feel the need to isolate themselves in this teeny little box. So that's the problem with the community. And she's feeling what many people feel. I agree with that particular thing. So going back to...
Sure, if Israel is traditional, they never change their constitution.
There, okay, so there you have it. But what to wrap up the whole course in terms of how this communal model, at least in principle, can work, what have I tried to do in 8 weeks, just to bring it all together? One is to talk about what is Jewish belief. That was week one. Just talking about that in order to understand inclusive orthodoxy, you need to understand what is tradition, right? So that was week one. Week two was about granting that many Jews either doubt, deny, or just don't know what Jewish beliefs are, what do we do? And there's the heretic model, and there's the understanding family model, right? So, and these are classic Jewish positions. So I advocated in favor of the mistaken Jew model rather than the heretic. The heretic is somebody who's contemptible in Jewish tradition, whereas somebody who's mistaken is somebody who is wrong. We can have disagreements, even fundamental disagreements, but we can still love them and talk to them. Right? In other words, there's a world of difference. In other words, we still want to teach the truth. We have to teach the truth. This is what Judaism has stood for thousands of years. You never back away from what Jewish belief is, but you can welcome and talk to people. In other words, that's why we had that discussion. In terms of creating Jewish unity, the rabbinic establishment needs to understand these are two fundamental positions. One is exclusionary. If everybody who doesn't think like you is a heretic, well, heretic is a very bad thing in Jewish tradition. Right? Whereas mistakes, people make mistakes, we don't, but everybody else. Lots and lots and lots of people make mistakes, and you can have fundamental mistakes even. So we can say people are fundamentally mistaken without being evil and without separating themselves from the community. And that's, I think, the key difference in week number two. Week number three, four, five, and six were all about how do you apply philosophy to Judaism? How do you apply mysticism to Judaism? How do you create religious experience? And talking about how these different trends of infusing halakha with meaning, where each one came from and where each one is going, and how even though, boy, oh boy, oh boy, you can have worlds of difference between people who are influenced by these different spheres, we can still get along even though we disagree. Right? And even though we, in certain cases, really disagree in terms of all of these things, but we can still consider ourselves part of it. Then we spent a couple of weeks talking about Rabbi Uziel and Rabbi Halevi as models of halakhic greatness by understanding the tradition very, very well and being committed to it, and by recognizing that the world is a complicated place, how do we best apply the principles of halakha to modernity? And in this regard, that's where you're going to have the big debates. Not just conversion, everything. How do you relate, you know, how do you build this ideal community? So to me, the focus is always on making sure that we're aware of modernity, and it's very complicated, aware of the fact that rabbis will debate the boundaries of how to apply law, and recognize that these are valid positions, even if we totally disagree. It's all part of the same thing. Nobody, creating Jewish unity, the mistake of certain forms of Judaism is that they're trying to promote conformity. That everybody needs to think and do and dress and look and everything exactly like we do, and that's Judaism, and everything else is not. Right? Judaism was never about conformity, and it can't be about conformity. We love to argue. I think I mentioned this in passing in an earlier week. Years and years and years ago, when I was 19 years old, I was about to start college, and I was an intern on Park Avenue. My favorite friend in the office was this guy who, Hispanic man, who grew up Catholic and now is a Lutheran. I don't know what he is now, but he was a Lutheran at the time, and he probably still is. Very religious man, also very irreverent man, who smoked way, 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 way too much and always reeked horribly. But other than that, he was a pleasure to be with. And one day I was just, you know, during lunch break, I had my chumash with me. A traditional Jewish chumash is flanked by commentaries. You have the text of the Torah in the middle, and then you have all these commentaries. So he sees Hebrew letters, so we were both seekers in our own way. He comes over to me, sees me reading this. What are you reading? So it's the Torah. He said, wow, that's cool, and it's in Hebrew, yeah. So then he said, well, what are all these smaller letters? I said, these are different great rabbis who lived in many different centuries. He said, wow, they're on the page? I said, yeah, traditional Jewish Bible, since printing was invented, this is how we do it. Right? You're surrounded. And then I told him, and this is the coolest part, not only that, but see this one over here? He is disagreeing vigorously with this one over here. And in fact, all of them are disagreeing severely, and if they weren't, they wouldn't have written anything. Right? They're always in disagreement. That's part of Jewish tradition. Right? Part of the goal of creating Jewish unity is never going to be, let's all be the same. But let's recognize that we're all Jews. We should all welcome each other, and not just us, but not just people who are more like-minded, but people, you know, we're all part of the same family. Halakha needs to be as inclusive as it can be without distorting the system. It goes back to Simon's point. And in an ideal world, Jews need to be respectful of what Judaism is. Right? In other words, because otherwise the system can't work. If people are disrespectful or say, let's change it, then nothing is ever going to work. That's an 8-week version of my, if I had to pin down in 8 weeks, how do you express what the Jewish community was, is, and needs to be? That's what I've tried to do. And I can't tell you how grateful I am, first of all, just to the Institute for making this possible. I've been dreaming about this course since I started working for it 18 months ago or so. But, you know, we should have a course just on, okay, what do we really stand for? What are the key values that make us tick? And so I got to read a lot of my father's works all over again, as well as lots of other books and articles, things to try to put together this course. And I'm very grateful to all of you. The discussions have been phenomenal. Everybody has contributed so meaningfully to everything that we've done. I love the questions, comments, follow-up emails, all the good stuff. And obviously, this is just the beginning. You know, 8-week course, which is now done, it doesn't mean, okay, now we've solved all the problems of the world and interpreted everything that needs to be interpreted. But I thought you got to start somewhere, and that's what an 8-week course is meant to do. And I'm really grateful to all of you for especially giving, and I'm grateful to Apple Bank for giving us this space. It was really cool. If you had told me a year ago we'd be having a class in the bank on whatever day of the week it is, Tuesday mornings from, you know, 8:40 to 9:30, I'd be like, oh, you know, it's
well, the synagogue I grew up in bought a bank building. Kept the
Torah in the vault. So I just want to thank all of you and wish you all a Chanukah Sameach, Happy Chanukah, and I look forward to learning with you in future settings. Before you go, if you're, everybody should of course be a member of the Institute. If you're not, they'll become one, of course. But on top of that, we have copies of the most recent issue of Conversations, which is the publication we put out 3 times a year, on that there table. So feel free to take them on the way out. If you already are a member and have a friend, you think, oh, this is something you'd like to give to somebody else, you can also take them in that capacity. Thank you so much.